and welcome to the MotoGP podcast. So this week, obviously, we didn't just have a race weekend, so that means it'll be another feature episode. And this time around, it's the turn of MotoGP legend, Freddie Spencer.
Yes, feature three coming at you this week. Freddie Spencer back in the MotoGP paddock full time this year as the FIM MotoGP stewards chairman of the panel. So basically, he'll be in charge of all the, how should we say, when there are discrepancies between riders, he can be the mitigating factor and deciding who is to blame and whatnot.
I like how you asked me how to say that and came out with the most erudite English I've ever heard from you.
Yeah.
But yeah, exactly.
We try sometimes. So yes, Freddie taking on a new role in 2019. So in this feature interview, which goes back into the archives from 2016, that's right, isn't it? We're taking the opportunity to go back and share some of his thoughts on his own career. Spencer, he starts in his youth when he says he began riding at only 4 years old, something that now is almost pretty much a prerequisite to riding in a world championship. But then it was a pretty early statement of intent for the young American.
Well, for me, it's, you know, I started riding at 4 years old, and at the time, that was very unusual. Everybody I raced against were minimum three or four years older than me. And it was obviously flat tracking, you know, on little mini bikes. And, you know, timing is everything. I came along with my parents and my brother and sisters after they got done with go-kart racing. And my sister was 14 years old when I was born. And so my dad and my brother liked bikes, and they were kind of getting in bikes, and I came along. So that's what influenced me when I was real little. And then I did an opportunity. Like I said, riding in my yard as a kid on little 50s and a little Honda 50. And then eventually I started following road racing when there was no Americans at the time in road racing in the world championships. But I knew that's what I wanted to do. And it's interesting because, you know, I started out as a kid in a state that didn't even have a road race track. In fact, in the Louisiana State Hall of Fame, I'm the only person in motorsports, you know. There was no road race track, and it was only me seeing a picture in the back of Cycle News is what I felt I should go and road race. And I had to ask my dad when I was 11 to get me a road race bike. When I first started, my brother was, my earliest memory was he was 18. And so I took 17. And my very first number plate on my mini enduro, the Yamaha, which was really the first little mini bike that had front rear suspension I had. And it was first two stroke. I chose 17 and I took black, like electrical tape, you know, that you wrap around electrical wiring and stuff. And I made this little number plate and I put a 1 and a 7. And because my brother had an L that designated that he was from Louisiana as a professional dirt track, I put 17L, even though I didn't need to put the L on there. And my brother was 18. And so whenever it became time for me to be a professional, turn professional, because I used 17 all the way through my early years, amateur flat tracking and things, and even in road racing a little bit. But when I got ready to turn professional, my brother had retired. He wasn't doing any more dirt tracking, and I couldn't get 17. And so the closest number I could get to that was 19.
As he says, Spencer wasn't exactly born into an area steeped in motorcycling culture or history. Shreveport, Louisiana is in the north of the state, about equidistant between Dallas and Jackson, and a far cry from Baton Rouge and New Orleans down on the coast. When he was starting to ride at 4 years old in 1966, the Civil Rights Act was only 2 years prior, and the assassination of Martin Luther King was still 2 years away. The southern United States wasn't draped in motorsport, although the first Grand Prix had been staged on American soil in 1964. It was one of only two Grand Prix, however, until the country returned to the calendar in 1988. In the interim, Americans arrived on the scene in serious numbers, and Spencer was one of them. For Spencer, motorcycling was something he somehow knew he was supposed to be doing. That faith is something that his background could arguably be responsible for. Not just religious, but more an iron-cast belief that it would go the way it did.
They work hand in hand, absolutely. And I say it like this. It's not so much about the religion part, but absolutely the faith. I'm a big believer, the interaction for me and the certainty of knowing this is exactly what I should do. And I always felt this from a little kid. For example, when I was about 6 years old, I saw a picture of Mr. Honda in the local Honda dealership, J.W. Gorman Power Cycle Honda. And it was Mr. Gorman and Mr. Honda standing next to each other. And, you know, years later, when I was watching the broadcast in 1979 of the British Grand Prix and watching the Hondas, you know, I felt that one day I'd race for them. So you can imagine 4 years later when I'm walking Mr. Honda's home and I meet him for the first time and I won the 500 World Championship, which was one of his dreams. For me, going back to when I was a kid at 6 years old and seeing that photo, it all connected. And to me, that's what faith is, you know, and it's a very interesting thing, that integration of belief and faith in what we do and that growth and what we share with others is to me what true faith is. And it's one of the things that I've, you know, learned through my motorcycling. And so, you know, one day when I met Mr. Honda, I told him this story. And he compared it like when he was starting the company in his garage and he knew one day he would build these bikes, you know. And so for me, it was a very amazing thing to share that and to one day race for Honda and kind of felt I always would.
Getting to that point and racing for Honda didn't quite begin on the tarmac though. Going back to Freddie's early days, dirt track was a big influence and it stayed that way for long after Fast Freddie was starting to mix it in with the international competition.
Dirt tracking is what gave me the opportunity to really hone my skills about what I see, what I sense and feel on a motorcycle, everything I understand about movement and controlling the movement with lean angle and body position and interacting with the motorcycle. And it's one of the things that I really enjoy most about riding a bike. And so it was riding my yard. It was flat tracking, a little oval racing, which was I kind of came along when there really wasn't a lot of, or there was no mini bike racing. I was the first in that area in the United States, in the southern part of the United States, the little area I was in. We got the opportunity as kids to dirt track. And then after that, it was graduating to bigger bikes and on quarter mile ovals. But still, it was riding in my yard that taught me everything I understand about how to control a bike's movement and riding on the dirt. Well, for example, and I'll give this as a perfect example of whenever my first experience outside the United States was when I was 18 years old, because at the time the minimum age to race international racing was 18. I had almost won the Daytona 200. I would have been still been the youngest Daytona winner, but when I was 18, I won a TZ 750 and battling with Kenny Roberts, and he was world champion at the time. But because I almost won that race, I got invited to the British Transatlantic Match Races, which was the next month. It was an amazing series at the time because it pitted the Americans against the Great Britain riders, European riders, and kind of a team. So anyway, I got invited to race there. And so when I showed up at Brands Hatch, everybody said how difficult the track is. And you're racing against the factory guys, and I'm a privateer with Irv Kanemoto. But the track, I was able to learn pretty quickly. It's off camera, a lot of elevation changes. It shocked people that I could learn a track so quickly. But for me, it was like riding a dirt track bike. An off camera corner, I just adjust my lean angle, you know, basically. You know, it's a left-hand corner, I pick. It's all about angles, flat tracking is. And so sliding the bike in those cold conditions, which it was on that Good Friday, I went out and I was able to beat the best guys in the world. First time I ever raced outside the United States and against them. But for me, my years of experience and understanding bike movement and how to load, you know, in off-camber corners, which is for me like riding in my yard, you know, like going through the trees and the precision it would take guiding my little 100 through a tree when it's wet and I'm riding over leaves, is no different than riding that TZ 750 for me on an off-camber corner and elevation changes at Brands Hatch. And it's just feel, you know, it is that ability to see and sense the movement. It's one of the great things we get to do riding a motorcycle.
So when Spencer did arrive in the World Championship, what did he think about that, arriving so young and the challenges that were ahead of him?
Yeah, I looked about 12, Eleanor. My children, it's so funny, they look back at a photo when I'm 21 years old and they go, Dad, you're about my age. My son's 14, you know. So, well, I'm a little bit older, but thank you, yeah. But the thing is that in reality, I'd had quite a bit of experience. And I think that helped me a lot, is I didn't go into the races thinking about being so young. I knew what I could do on a motorcycle, and so it was opportunity. My first full season, I only knew one track, you know, which was Silverstone. You know, all the other ones were new. Brand new motorcycle, brand new team. And so the learning curve was pretty dramatic. And you're racing on tires, and again, on a 500 that you would never race, get a chance to ride in the United States or in any other series. And so it's from that standpoint, there was no coming up through the ranks. You know, I went from nothing right into the 500s, so.
Fast Freddy's first full season was in 1982, and he opened his account with a first podium first time out. Hey, how about that? And the first win wasn't long coming either. As he explains, it was a long road from January to the top step, though.
When I tested the bike in January, we were so late because when they built the bike, I saw the engine the first time in July of 81. And then they finally got a bike built. And then I went to Japan a couple of times in the fall of 81 and never got to ride the bike because I'd show up and one of the test riders was in the hospital, transmission locks up. And there was all these, because it was a three cylinder, it vibrated. They had never built a counter shaft or, you know, counter rotating balancing shafts to, you know, all this was just new. I mean, the company's brand new. This was their first bike, all these things. So it wasn't until January I got to ride the bike the first time, and it was at Laguna Seca. And when I first rode the bike, it felt like a motocross bike a little bit, just the engine response. I didn't really have that much experience on a 500. I'd ridden Yamaha in 1980 at Zolder and then the NR 500 at Silverstone the previous summer. So my limited experience riding the 500, but I knew it didn't feel right. So they went back and we were all gonna, the team that was gonna be racing that year was Marco Lucanelli, defending 500 world champion, Takazumi Katayama and myself. So the first time we got together was in February, which was basically just 1 month before the first Grand Prix in March in Argentina. We got to Brazil, the bike was a little better, definitely better than when I rode it a month before. And it was somewhat, you know, it was reliable, didn't have any problems, had some overheating problems, but we felt, we had no idea how it was gonna be against anyone, but it felt like it was definitely better. So we show up at the first Grand Prix at Buenos Aires, and right away, the bike was better than it was in February, and we weren't too bad. And I think it shocked everyone. But the track, I think, was it wasn't that big, wasn't really high speed, and it had tight corners, and which require some things that the characteristics of the three-cylinder was supposed to be good at, which was agility. And narrow, pretty light, supposed to be pretty light. Wasn't as light as they hoped, but it was pretty good. We started the race, and I got off, you know, qualified good, got off, and now I'm in a battle with Kenny and Barry. And it was a first chance, obviously, to kind of see where the competition was. And about halfway through the race, you know, I could take the lead and you know, leading some laps. And I started thinking that there's a chance that we could maybe win this thing. But it was hot that day, and bike started to overheat and slowing down a little bit and ended up getting third. But it was an amazing start, considering what most people don't realize is the difference between that bike in March from January was dramatic improvement. So I can imagine how bad it was at the end of 81 when I didn't get a chance, but all the test riders and just development, and it was just really dramatic increase in performance. And So, you know, that kind of set the stage that, one, we could be competitive. And immediately they're already thinking when we're going to get that first win. So it went from we didn't know what we're going to be to our expectation level was pretty high. And I almost won in Spain. I was leading the Spanish Grand Prix at Jarama, had a coil wire break. And we were, you know, had a couple other races right there. But when we got to Spa, we didn't really think it'd be a track. And in practice, you know, I just didn't know how we were gonna do. Ended up qualifying second, but got in the race, didn't get that great of a start, but just started moving up the pack, caught Kenny, and passed him, and then won the race. And it was just an amazing, amazing feeling to win at that time, July 4th, you know, 1982.
So how does it feel, and how did it feel, being the youngest winner for more than 30 years?
You know, it's one of those things that you don't really, it's a personal goal. And to, like I said, it wasn't until after the race that day at Spa that I even knew I'd broken that record. My dream was to maybe be the youngest world champion. But that goal was kind of getting close. You know, we only had one more year. 83 was, I had to do it that year or I wouldn't break Mike's record. So it was, for me, it was such a pleasure to give that for the team. And it's one of the great things we're able to do together. And I knew how hard everybody was working. And even though it was the first year, 82 was the first year with HRC, you got to understand, for them, they had been back in Grand Prix racing for 4 years. So even though it was the first year for that particular entity, there was a lot of expectation and pressure that had built up over the years. Okay, now you got a two-stroke, you need to go out and start being successful. And so, you know, it was nice for all of us to get that out of the way, get that first win.
So from then, Spencer and Honda went from strength to strength. Third overall in 1982 set him up perfectly for an assault on the crown the year after in 1983. And it started with three wins in a row, with another trio of victories by the end of the season. Fast Freddy was only off the podium twice, and it meant he achieved his dream, took his first world championship, and he was the youngest ever to do it. He was also the first 500cc crown for Honda.
When Mr. Honda started the company, he had two dreams. You know, well, the first was to build bikes, motorcycles. He started with bicycles, putting little Honda engines on them, because he wanted to give to the average, you know, person, Japanese, and eventually the world, the chance to ride a motorcycle. He loved that, and he loved building engines. It's kind of like the same thing Henry Ford, you know, with the Model T. He wanted to be able to build a bike that was able for the average person to be able to drive and to share that. And then once, you know, he obviously wanted to compete. And so to build a bike that would compete first in the Isle of Man and then to win the 500 World Championship. And so when they weren't able to do it in the 60s, they got out of racing. And then they came back in the late 70s with a bike called the NR500, which is the bike that I saw on that broadcast. And it wasn't really successful on the track, but it was an amazing technical achievement. And it was the bike that actually furthered along the engine development with the V4s, which I got the pleasure of racing. Now, when I signed for Honda in 1980, they didn't have a Grand Prix bike. There was no HRC. But they had told me at the end of 1980, after my first year of racing AMA Superbike, that they were going to start this company, and it was HRC, and they were going to build a two-stroke. And I stayed with Honda because I believed in them, and I believed in the people. I knew I was supposed to race for them. I felt that. And of course, we went on to win the world championship in 83. And it gave me one of my dreams, which was I wanted to be the youngest 500 world champion. And that broke Mike Helwood's record. And so all these years later, just real brief, all these years later, when Mark had the chance in 2013, people would ask me, does it bother you? And I said, absolutely not. I think it's great that someone has come along and has a chance to give them something that was so special to me. And then, of course, he rides a Honda and basically for the same team. So it was very cool.
It was a dream realised, but it didn't come easy. So how does Spencer remember that season, the rivalry with Kenny Roberts? Here he talks us through some of that 1983 season.
Like I said, my preparation for that season started way before the beginning or even in winter testing. It was I knew by watching once they built that V4, the Yamaha, which Yamaha's at that time, and I would pay attention to this even before I got to the Grand Prix. I kind of knew the tendencies of not only the riders but also the manufacturers and how they would develop the bikes and things. And I noticed going back to 1980 when they would bring over new parts. My first Grand Prix was at Zolder, but I'd watch Kenny and the way he liked the bike. You know, he liked the engine way far back in the chassis, and so how stable the bike was. And so whenever got in 82 and they brought that V4, which was at Salzburgring, and I passed him during the race. I qualified 12th, and I can tell you today, I passed him on the front straightaway going in turn one. And I watched the tendency of the bike, and so I would catalog that. And as the season went on, and as our development, and I watched the V4, I knew what I needed to work on in the winter months. And I would work on it as much off the track as on. Like when I was a kid, laying in my bed at night, I would go through the bike and the movements, and the next day I would implement that in my riding in my yard when I was 8, 9 years old. So I knew all the things that I needed to make adjustments, and then things that I would talk with Irv about and with all the engineers and ways to improve the motorcycle so that we could work better together. And when we started the championship at Kyle Ami, getting a start on certain racetracks was my first most important thing, and I won the race there and ended up winning the first three races. Now when we got to Monza, the Italian Grand Prix, for the third race, already that was a track that I knew we would struggle on. For example, through Ascari, which I love Monza. As a kid, my goal was to one day hopefully win the Italian Grand Prix at Monza. And on actually talking about that on Thursday, is I normally would never actually predict this, but I told her I think we're going to win this weekend, even though I knew it was going to be tough. That gave me a 25-point lead, and I told her afterwards, I said, the rest of the season is going to be managing that. And it ended up being exactly that, all the way to the point to where basically, you know, we're either he's winning or I'm winning. And we both had a did not finish, and we get to all the way to the British Grand Prix at Silverstone. And I remember on Friday afternoon, I'm sitting in my garage, and I'm just absolutely exhausted from the season. And we're at the point in the championship to where I can't even hardly get at Silverstone, being a high-speed circuit. I cannot even get within the same second of Kenny. And I thought the only way that I'm going to maintain my championship was I have to get second or I'm gonna lose it. And it had kind of worked out to where I kind of thought it was. The most I had was after the Italian Grand Prix, that 25 points, and now I'm down to just single digits. Kenny would go along going in the race, but I was battling with Kenny, with Randy and Eddie and the other four cylinders, and just hanging on. I mean, if I told you hanging on at the edge, just hanging on like the edge of a building that day at Silverstone, to the point where every single corner I was saving it. And because with that three cylinder at a high speed circuit like that with the V4s, by that time of the season, just the torque of the V4s and development of the Yamahas from 82 to 83, we were just hanging on. But I came out of the race, I got second because of the restart and the way the aggregate time, by just 0.03 of a second. And it was just one of those critical moments that of course leads to the next weekend at Sweden, which everybody remembers. But it was really that day at Silverstone to where I just kind of hung on. And it shows how not only do we have to manage and we think about what we're doing on the motorcycle, but just how the seasons fit together. And that particular season, because of the battle with Kenny and I, every single race, I knew how difficult it was going to be with him.
But there was one moment more than many which stands out. That mythical race in Sweden came down to the final corner and a move that gave Spencer the win. But it was a controversial moment, as well as a key one in the Spencer-Roberts rivalry.
Well, the Swedish, we started off in practice, and I was quick. I was quite a bit quicker than Kenny. And I thought, we got this under control. It should be, you know, in reality, or it's the way the practice went, and the speed advantage I had over him, I thought we have this under control. Start the race on Sunday. And the tendency in the races, the ones where we would battle, and even the ones, you know, ones I would win or the ones he would win, it would start off like this. I'd get a good start, I'd get out front, try to pull away a little bit, and then he would, you know, kind of hunt me down, and then I would hang on to him, and then our tires. He was on Dunlops, I was on Michelin's, they would kind of balance out, and now the race was on. The characteristics of the Yamaha and the Honda were completely different, and mine and Kenny's riding style was different. So it made for great racing, like the battle we had at the Spanish Grand Prix earlier in the year. It went down to the last lap. The only lap I led across the start finish line was the last lap, and the last lap it was a lap record. With no brakes, tires were gone. Exhausted. It was such a hard race. I was so exhausted afterwards. But we passed each other all the time because, again, bikes being different characteristics and things. So we get that day at Sweden, and I was, like I said, quickest in practice. When we started the race, he was with me right away, and he had been obviously sandbagging because his pace in the race was a lot higher. He gets out front, and I barely can stay with him. I mean, it really shocked me, but I shouldn't have. I should have known, you know, and it was great strategy on his part. But anyway, I'm hanging on to him, and so now the race is going to come down to, because he just doesn't usually make mistakes. He had that one at Monza, very, very unusual. That was the only one, really, all year. So now it's, where am I going to pass him? And like I said, I really didn't have an advantage anywhere. Our bikes being a little bit different, certainly I'm going to be stronger in certain areas than others, but it's not going to be any place, it doesn't seem like, as the race is going on, any place where I'm able to really get by. So we get to about 5 or 6 laps to go, and the only thing I can think of maybe doing, situation, and certainly you make adjustments, is the last corner lean onto the back straightaway was banked. And on the exit, because it was the Anderstor track is an old Air Force base, it levels off onto which is the runway, basically, the old airport runway on the back straightaway. And he doesn't know that on the back straightaway, that basically I'm just kind of hanging on, or had been hanging on to him. So he tightens up his line, I move out here on the exit. As he comes off the corner, the bike is a lot more lean angle than he normally would have, because with tighten up the line, the lean angle is going to be have to hold a little longer on the exit. His bike, under acceleration, rear end brakes loose, and it wheelies. The only time it did it. I'm up here, I get my best drive, he gets his worst drive. And as we're going down the back straightaway, because of that, I'm able to get up and get up next to him. And as we come to the end of the back straightaway, because it's wide, it narrows up, it's kind of a little bit of a kink. Not a pure kink, but a little bit of a kink. Well, I'm right here. And as we get closer to the braking zone, I normally watch him. But this one particular time, I've glanced at him watching his hand. And when it's time to brake. He goes to brake. He sets up, but he doesn't roll off throttle. And I'm not going to roll off till he does, you know. And so we basically are both, at this point, really deep into the corner, a lot deeper than we think. Now, I'm smiling now at that moment. You're just, you know, I'm hanging on. I'm on the brakes. He's on the brakes. And when we got down to the corner, I'm under him, and he basically is here. And I run wide, and we run a little bit wide. You can see it in the video. Now, we didn't touch, you know. And Kenny had a little bit of a better angle. But when he got on the throttle, his rim broke loose and it got off the edge, and I was able to get by him, and then it's just one next corner and I win the race. Certainly he was not happy, I understand. We didn't touch, but it's like I told him afterwards. I mean, he would have done the same thing. And it's like when he passed me at La Source during the Belgium Grand Prix, and we ran a little bit wide. The championship is on the line. And you got to understand, I not only knew how difficult it was going to be at IMLA, I'm aware of that at that moment, you know, of all the possibilities, what I'm going to be facing, this opportunity, watching his hand, setting up the pass on the entrance, all these things that kind of made that happen. And it worked out and it worked out in my favor. But I understand, you know, one of the things that made it difficult, and I got pummeled in the press about it. And I understand, I'm the young guy and he's the veteran. And it, you know, this was his last championship and everything was on the line. But at the time, there was no cameras down at that angle, you know, that part of the track. All they saw was is me on the inside and Kenny kind of off the track and I won the race. But, you know, we, for years and years and years, we never really talked about it. It's like I told him a few years ago. Is, you know, that championship, it took, if, you know, you have an ability, you give an ability, which I believe people are, and then the work ethic and everything it took to win that championship, and it raised my performance to a level because of competing with him.
So from there, now we'll move forward a little bit to 1985. That year saw Spencer take on the 250 and 500 World Championships in the same season, coming off the back of a more difficult year in 1984, no less. So how did that decision come about, and how difficult was it to do that?
It all started, the decision to do the two championships, and it was interesting because we didn't really have a good, you know, 584. Won a couple of races with the bike with gassing on the bottom, but we knew they kind of figured out pretty early in the season that we was going to be moving away from that because of the unpredictability of the bike. It wasn't easy to work on. The mechanics struggled. We lost the race in the Dutch Grand Prix in 84 because the spark plug cap came off. But when I came in, you couldn't get your hands in there with the exhaust to even put it back on. So there was a lot of that, the technical side as well as the limitations that bike had. We knew we were going to conventional for 85. Didn't have a 250 when we decided to do it, but they built the 250. So in winter testing, in one of our first meetings, and what a crew, as it turns out, that we had assembled with Irv Kanemotico and Jerry Burgess and George Vukmanovich on the 500s. Stuart Shenton was my 250 crew, and of course you look at their resumes and the world championships that they won and would end up winning is pretty amazing. But one of the things when we were sitting down and talking, I said, you know, we're talking about developing the bikes, but I said, what I've got to be able to do is to make the adapt to a bike in the siding lap. When we're doing practice sessions at the time, you know, they're back to back, literally, when one is finishing, the other would be going out right away, pretty close. And so, you know, I can't sit down with the crew and debrief on the 250. I need to be out on the 500. I can't miss 5 or 10 minutes of the first of the practice, because of those days every session was qualifying, and plus you can't anyway, you need every lap and you're working and trying things. So all of those things were really the foundation things that I had to make sure to do as the rider, and then I had to be able to make adjustments quickly again, and I started in testing working toward that. So when we started the season, the 500 wasn't that great because we got the bike late, building the conventional bike. The 250 was pretty good right away. And we were also developing the radial tires, making that transition from bias to radial. So there was a lot of that background, you know, things that we were having to adjust to and improve and work on, more than just getting on the bike and riding, you know. There was all of kind of the logistics part, the foundation part, the practical things. So then that way, when I got on the bike and started a race, we were prepared. And so I of course remember every race, and we could talk about all the great battles I had, especially with Tony Main and Carlos Salvato on the 250. But it was those things that were the critical things that allowed me to be in a position that we worked out in the off season and preparation wise, and knew that there was going to be an issue with the amount of time I would have testing. So, you know, being able to give feedback that that we were able to do so when we got into the season and we had the problems we had, we were prepared for them.
But what about a specific moment or memory from that year? After winning both titles, it must have been a hard choice to make. But Spencer, he focuses on the Italian Grand Prix.
Well, the probably most dramatic weekend was the Italian Grand Prix in May, because leading up to that, we'd had a couple chances to win both races in the same day. You're at the time they called it the Nations Grand Prix, it's the Italian Grand Prix, and it was at Mugello. And typical Mugello, extremely hot and difficult, and especially a 500 around there, because the track, as soon as it gets greasy, and the 500 is difficult to ride on a good day when it's not, when you got good traction. I knew it was going to be tough, but the thing that was working a little bit in my favor as far as race configuration that weekend was 500s first, so I could get the 500, the most difficult race out of the way. And I was quickest, you know, in practice and in the race. I was able to get a little bit of a lead, but Eddie and Christian would have a good battle, was having a good battle for second. And their pace was pushing me, and I was able to win the race. I'm standing on the podium, and, you know, I was popping the champagne in the national anthem. I couldn't drink any because 250 races next. And so Eddie, I'd give him the champagne to Eddie. And so I'd never forget, I'm standing there, and it's just hot, and I'm thinking, okay, good, I'm going to get to have a few, you know, bottles of water, the normal routine would be. And then I could quickly change leathers or something, because, you know. And I never forget, I'm standing there, and the national anthem, as soon as it ends, I hear the 250s crank up, and they're heading out of the cold pit. I couldn't believe it, that it was that close. Now, I'm not going to have any time to go to the motorhome and drink any water or anything, not even change anything. And so I look at Eddie, and Eddie, all he says is, better you than me. I'll never forget that. It's like, I don't know. So I am running to the code pack, and all the bikes have left. And the only guy sitting there is Tony Mayne. And he wasn't going to leave that pit I did. I really respected him for that and appreciated that. And he just nodded. And so I get on the bike, and so I go out and do the sighting lap like normal. And like I said earlier, I would already know. I didn't really use braking markers a lot then. I did everything pretty much on the field. So I it was easy for me not to have to make adjustments with that. I just immediately would go in around the 250. And that means I'm accelerating, get down the corner. I knew exactly where, just seeing it, where I was going to get on the brakes. So I could do that on the sighting lap. And so anyway, I get back and we go through the normal procedure and announcement, this cold start, and I do the warm-up lap. I come back, and because we're bump started at the time, you kill the engine. So I'm standing there, get off the bike, put in first gear, you back it up and get the thing ready to go. So I'm watching. And the beautiful thing about that day is in that, because it was dramatic, because there was no sound. And there's something pretty kind of cool and dramatic. You know, there's a lot of drama in that. And all these thousands of people, you could hear a pin drop before the start of the race. So they you know, throw at that time a flag. So I go to push, and I'll never forget, I'm pushing, and it's like all the bikes are going by, and I throw my leg over the bike, and I'm thinking, my mind is up to speed. Like I should be up there, but my body is not reacting, you know? And I was just exhausted. And so I start, and I told Irv before the start, I said, you know, the main thing is on a day like today, in these conditions, this hot, is you gotta get a good start, because I didn't want to let Carlos and Tony go. And I come around the first lap, and I'm 19th. Right, I'm thinking the worst possible thing. The one day I'm exhausted, I'm in 19th. But fortunately, I was kind of got a second win, and I end up catching Carlos with like about 5 or 6 laps to go. And I won both races that day. And so that was obviously a great day in the most difficult conditions, you know. But I'll never forget that feeling of, it's like a surreal thing. I'm pushing and I'm jumping on the bike, my mind's saying go, and all the bikes are going by, and, you know. So it was obviously ended up being a good day.
For Spencer then, 1985 was a tough year, but it was also his best year ever.
Well, it was certainly, as far as the achievement, It was definitely, absolutely. And any time you win a race, and I feel this way, it's just the way I feel, is it's a privilege and it's great because how difficult it is and how hard it is to do that and the effort it takes and for not only yourself but your team and all the support it takes to be able to achieve that. And so, of course, you know, I won 14 races that year, 7 on each bike. And you know, obviously quite a few times I won both races single day, like in Italy and Spa and in Austria and the French Grand Prix. So that was an incredible accomplishment to know on that day you are the best at what you do, of course, and to be able to do it in two classes and to win the championship. Certainly the 83 season was an amazing achievement because that was unexpected, racing against a great rider like Kenny. And so they're different, you know, 83 and 85.
And from the peak of that season, though, things got tough. In 1986, it saw Spencer struck by injury and fitness struggles, and suddenly it was all over.
Well, I had some wrist problems, obviously. It's well documented. And, you know, I prepared for 86, and I had laid off after 85, didn't actually test a bike or ride or anything. And things just changed, and I'll never forget that feeling. It was the Spanish Grand Prix, and like I said, I'd worked harder in January, February, March, get ready for 86, than I even in 85. And I was just going to do the one championship in 86. And I went out and qualified on the pole for the race Friday, Saturday, and was leading the Spanish Grand Prix de Rome. And I was about 10 laps to go, I had about 11-second lead. I'm coming down the hill into the hairpin. I go to get on the front brake, and I squeeze, and nothing happens. It literally, I couldn't squeeze the lever. And I dealt with the numbness and the pain, and actually, because it had started in 85, that's why I laid off, one of the reasons I laid off between 85 and 86. And you know, at the time, they didn't really know what carpal tunnel was, didn't know what the issue was. Nobody had ever experienced that. And we ran all these tests afterwards, and the damage I'd already done, and then when they went and did the surgery, it was just never the same. But that was a tremendously dramatic moment, you know, for me, because it just was over in that instant. The thing is that, you know, everybody's, you know, physically different. And for me, the, you know, probably the wear and tear I'd been riding for, you know, at that point, you know, basically 19 years. And I'd started so young. But it was basically over, you know, for me. Yeah, issues or injuries, crashes, or, you know, things that happen that just work against what you're doing, and that's the most difficult, and certainly that's the most difficult thing. But it's also one of the challenges about what we do is sometimes the difference. For example, in 83, there were three races that I won where we killed the engine at the end of the race. When they went to restart it, it wouldn't even start. The main bearings were in the bottom of the cases, and things went my way then. And other times they didn't through the injuries, or, you know, where you just miss something and you're able to save it that could have went that other way. And, you know, and fortunately it's a part of it. And it's disappointing, certainly for yourself and certainly for the people who support you. And that's the hard part of what we do. It's also the responsibility that we share, you know. You inspire and disappoint sometimes.
From talking about his own career then, let's hear him talk a little bit more about the era as well. So one thing that's always a good debate amongst fans is the level of respect. And on the grid back then, does he think that was a real strong point in the competition?
Sure. You have your, and again, you have your disagreements and things, you know, or just the fact of, but it's because it matters so much, you know. I mean, it's like what happened with Kenny and I. I mean, he cared so much. He knew the championship was on the line, and me too, of course. And you go out and you do the best you can, and then, but afterwards, you know, it's like Kenny told me after 83, and it's the biggest, best compliment he could give, is we were walking off the podium, and he just looked at me and said, I gave it all I had, you know, and that's all you can do.
From off track to on track, we've also got to hear something about those bikes from that era. Here are some of Freddie's thoughts on the machinery from the time that he was a racer.
One of the things about the 500s from that day, there's a couple of things. One is, and I like this, I'm glad I came along in this era for a couple of reasons. You know, I'm not one of those that really looks at eras and say this is better and this, I don't think like that. I've ridden bikes from every generation, 50s, 60s, Grand Prix bikes, 70s, race late 70s, you know, 80s, of course, and 90s, and I've ridden the modern bikes. And they're all different, they're all motorcycles to me, and they're different and they have their unique characteristics. But one of the things that I really like about coming along when I did was the leap in technology, and from this standpoint, is chassis development, and because of the battles that started between Yamaha and Suzuki in the mid to late 70s, it's one of the reasons why when Honda came out with the NR579, the four-stroke, it wasn't competitive. Because when they decided really to do that project in the mid 70s, about 76, the two-strokes were kind of performing at this pace. But with the battle with Suzuki coming in Yamaha, they really dramatically increased performance over a couple of years. Then when Honda came along in 82, when we started with HRC, the pace was at this with Yamaha and Suzuki. And then all of a sudden, the battle between Yamaha and Honda dramatically increased. Our leaps in understanding geometry. You have between the bias ply tires in 83, 84, and when we went to radials in 85. If you look at just lap times, for example, the 82 Belgium Grand Prix, I won that race, and I ran 2:36 lap in the fastest lap in the race. In 1985, when I won the race, it was running 2:28. That's a lot. In three, four years. And that's just going from the three-cylinder V3 to V4, aluminum box chassis, the suspension brakes, and the transition from bias to radials. You can't imagine, I mean, now if you make a 2 or 3 tenths of a second or a half a second, but the dramatic increase in pace, you know, my race winning pace in 1982, I wouldn't even finish in the top 10, 15, you know, in the race in 85, would have been even close. I would have lapped myself, basically. So it's an amazing time in dramatic increase in performance and what we begin to understand about geometry, how to transfer weight, the bike, and from as a rider, it was amazing. And so the 500s at the time, and even today when some of the guys go back and ride them, it's that connection with the motorcycle that's amazing because it's just pure. It's just what you have in this right hand, what you feel the throttle. And because of the two-stroke engine characteristics, the way that the power comes in, it's pretty amazing. And so it's a real treat to ride, obviously. They're priceless, the memories. But one of the things that I really liked about it was the striving to control, or not control, but just being able to be so far ahead of what the bike's going to do. And those were the great days. You know, people call it like getting in the zone, where, and I call it like this, is the basic approach to riding a bike of that caliber that really will go as fast as you want to go, and it doesn't limit you, is so practical in that respect, and methodical. It's planning, it's knowing exactly what it takes to get the bike from this point to this point to this point. But you do it completely on it happening out in front of you, what you see and what you trust to be able to sense and feel that bike to this point, to this point, to this point. And that is what riding a 500 at its best is all about. And fortunately, in many, many races for me, it felt where I was so in touch and so in tune with what's going on, and where it's easy. It actually, everything happens in slow motion, and those are the great days. And And again, I think it's when you get into that place, and that's where the mental, the thought process, and we, it's amazing what we can actually do if we allow it to happen, to where it's just, you're so clear and precise, to where it's just, you're so far ahead of it, where it's that type feeling. And that's the connection. It's, and again, as I said earlier, and I think it's a common thing that you hear so many people in motorsports, where it's, you connect so well, where you anticipate, to where you're that in tune with what's happening, to where it almost seems like you're just, your awareness. And that's what it's about. It's that incredible awareness that happens when you anticipate and you see it so well.
So as well as the bike and the competition and everything else, what really is motorcycling and what has it given to Freddie Spencer?
Well, it's first and foremost, the opportunity to really hone my skills of what I see, sense, and feel, and the opportunity to apply what I felt I was supposed to do as a kid, and to strive to work toward that goal. And it's interesting because, you know, I started out as a kid in a state that didn't even have a road race track. In fact, in the Louisiana State Hall of Fame, I'm the only person in motorsports, you know. There was no road race track, and it was only me seeing a picture in the back of Cycle News is what I felt I should go and road race. And I had to ask my dad when I was 11 and to get me a road race bike. And so to have that chance to basically strive and to go out in the world and to hone those skills, motorcycling gave me. And it's a very personal thing. And then all the people and opportunities to travel the world that I'm still getting to do is because of motorcycling.
Well, there you have it. Some extraordinary stories from an extraordinary man. A really, really enjoyable feature, that one with Freddie Spencer. Thank you very much for your hard work with that, Fran, as ever. Next week, we have another feature, though. What's on that one?
On that one, we are going to be hearing from the inimitable Nick Harris, the former voice of MotoGP, absolute legend. And we're very much looking forward to hearing some of Nick's thoughts on some seriously big names from the history of the sport. So everyone from Mick Doohan, Valentino Rossi, a little bit more modern there, and all the way back to the old days and the likes of Barry Sheen and Mike Hailwood.
Yes, well, that will also be coming up on the Thursday, which is of the Argentina GP Race Week. So that'll be on the press conference day. So yes, make sure you tune into that one next week. We'll speak to you then.